Welcome to The Investment Conversation. I'm Tim Paulson, investment strategist at Lord Abbott.
I call this the Humpty Dumpty economy. You know, when the economy fell into the chasm, triggered by the shutdowns that were necessary to deal with the healthcare crisis in early 2020, a lot of pieces shattered. What we're finding is that the pieces are not fitting together again.
What you just heard was a snippet from a podcast we did a year ago with Giulio Martini, Lord Abbott Partner and Director of Strategic Asset Allocation. You know, that framing, that concept of Humpty Dumpty was just a really useful way for advisors, investors to get their minds around what had changed so quickly with the economy. You break things, you put them back together, it's not the same, there's going to be a lot of friction. Probably time for a new update. Maybe a new way to easily get our minds around something that isn't so easily simplified. Giulio, I have to say, I think that framing held up incredibly well. And yet, a year later, we have more information. We've got maybe more framing that needs to be done because while the pieces still haven't fit back together very nicely, we have a little more clarity about specifically what's causing some problems. And, you know, a year ago at this time, we had a dovish Fed, no longer.
First of all, Tim, it's good to be with you and update these ideas together. And so I look forward to the conversation. You know, the idea of the Humpty Dumpty economy was really trying to, you know, use a metaphor to describe a series of imbalances which had developed in the economy and which would be difficult to bring back together again. And there are imbalances between supply and demand that really cut across many different important parts of the economy. So the first one that we talked about were unbalanced consumer demand because COVID-19 had caused spending to shift very aggressively into goods and away from services. And because supply potential, both in the U.S. economy and globally in goods, was limited, what we saw was inflation jump up in goods categories and push overall inflation higher. The second significant imbalance between demand and supply was in the labor market, where we first saw, you know, very large layoffs in March and April of 2020. Then we saw the labor market come roaring back, the unemployment rate go down from a high of 14.6% very quickly back into, you know, the 6 and 7% range that we're much more accustomed to. But what we found out really was that the jobs people were coming back to were different from the jobs that they had departed from initially. And so we saw a big increase in the quit rate in the economy. We saw a big increase in vacancies as firms tried to replace workers who had left. And that has persisted at a rate that's really unprecedented. Now there are over 11 million vacant jobs in the U.S. That's twice as many vacancies as the number of workers who are unemployed. And a job not for only every unemployed worker, but for also people who are outside of the labor market who might become employed in the near future. And we've never seen that kind of demand for labor relative to readily available supply. Another imbalance that developed very quickly was in the housing market, where the demand for housing went up as a result of COVID, people working from home, people wanting to work remotely as they start, you know, as firms open back up again. And that big increase in demand for housing took place against a backdrop where for many, many years after the subprime bubble burst, there was under construction of new housing units. And so what we find now is vacancy rates at an all-time low, both for owner-occupied housing and for rental units. And over the past 2 years, home prices have increased by 30 to 35%, which is really a record increase in home prices over that period. So that very important market remains very much unbalanced. And then the last imbalance that I had mentioned was an imbalance between imports and exports in the United States, which has resulted in an expansion of the U.S. trade and current account deficit, because many of the goods that demand increased for so dramatically were produced overseas. And as a result, the trade deficit widened, you know, enormously. And we have that imbalance, which is brewing in the background right now. All of this is also taking place in an environment of heightened uncertainty. We've just gone through, you know, an unprecedented event, a global pandemic, you know, where a lot of people got sick. A lot of people, unfortunately, passed away. You know, the way that we recover from that is unclear. So the path ahead for businesses, for individuals, you know, for public policy is not something that's mapped out clearly. And so we're all functioning in this environment of heightened uncertainty, which means closing the gap between its supply and demand is happening, but it's happening very slowly. So, you know, the outgrowth of all these imbalances, as we talked about last year, was inflation that we believed would be more stubborn and more endemic in the recovery than was appreciated at the time. But that has certainly changed. I think the idea that, you know, inflation is a problem we're going to have to deal with and take seriously, that it's not just transitory, is now widely appreciated. And I should also say that, of course, you know, a new serious wrinkle has come along because of the war in Ukraine, pushing energy and food prices up dramatically. And that has added to the underlying kind of inflationary impulse that was generated by COVID itself. So now all of these things have converged in a serious problem. Central banks around the world understand it's not just a supply chain issue. It's not just a transitory issue where when we, you know, largely recover from COVID, these problems are going to go away. Instead, it's something that they've started to deal with head on by tightening monetary policy around the world. And we're in the early stages of that. But the early stages of that have been much more significant than people believe they would be, you know, 6 or 12 months ago.
You use the word demand a number of times. And I think when a lot of people first sort of conceive of this Humpty Dumpty, it was easy to get their, you know, their heads around this idea that the supply chain had somehow broken and wasn't being reassembled quickly. But of course, some of the real changes that have happened are with regard to demand shifts and preferences there. And I think maybe it's just a useful place to start because, of course, when we bring the Fed into the equation and the Fed is trying to be very active with this, the Fed really has a very blunt instrument to try and impact demand. So maybe we can just talk a little bit about just what the Fed can do about demand. You know, you mentioned the labor imbalance with supply demand. We've got an outsized demand for labor. In theory, that's supposed to be a good thing. The Fed is kind of watching that. How does this play out? What can the Fed really do? And how much is demand really the problem?
Well, monetary policy and specifically rising interest rates do restrain demand. I mean, before we get off it totally, we should also say it restrains supply as well. But, you know, in a first instance, higher interest rates restrain demand. We're seeing the earliest manifestation of that in sharply reduced home sales, home purchases, higher financing costs together with much higher home prices have reduced affordability dramatically. And we've seen, you know, a 20 or 30% drop in new home sales and existing home sales. That's the sort of canary in the coal mine, potentially, for broader declines in demand in the economy as a whole. When you look at the other components of that rising interest rates effect, you know, consumer durables purchases have been very strong, and that's an area that's potentially vulnerable to tighter monetary policy. We haven't seen big decreases in durable spending yet, but that could be in the offing. Business fixed investment, certainly vulnerable to rising interest rates, and it's really the primary channel that people think about when they think about tightening monetary policy. But I actually think it could be much more resilient this time around because, You know, when you look back to the beginning of the national income and product accounts in the late 1940s, and you examine business fixed investment, spending on intellectual property was 20% business fixed investment back then in the early days. Now it's 40%. So what that is spending on R&D, spending on software, spending on copyrighted items. And if you look historically, those categories of spending are not particularly cyclical or really sensitive to increases in interest rates. So what you're talking about now is monetary policy acting through equipment purchases by businesses, non-residential construction, so offices, warehouses, retail establishments. But again, if you look at non-residential construction, about 20% of business fixed investment, it's at an all-time low as a share of GDP. So when you ask yourself, how much is rising, you know, how much are rising interest rates going to affect aggregate demand? You're faced with a composition of business fixed investment, which looks pretty resilient. It's really the 40% that's equipment that's vulnerable at this point in time. And then, you know, of course, the other big question is what's the position of inventories in the economy? Because what we've seen in the past is when the Fed acts to slow down demand, if that's happening in an environment in which there have been excess in the past, in the form of overproduction, then you can get very sharp cuts in production, layoffs going along with that, that then feed into a much weaker economy. But as far as we can tell right now, you know, inventories, which were run down very dramatically during, you know, the shutdown and the immediate post-shutdown economy, have not been rebuilt aggressively. So again, you can't really say that there's been overproduction that we need to correct for going forward. So in my mind, yes, monetary policy acts through rising interest rates that restrain demand. But if you look at the situation right now, the economy looks pretty resilient apart from home sales. And that's something that should concern the Fed, because it really means that they may have to tighten more than they or the markets are discounting right now, if what they ultimately need to do is slow things down enough to get the unemployment rate to go.
Well, and I think this is something that's been hard for me, a lot of investors too, to just get their heads around, is things that we usually think of as a positive, a resilient economy. Doesn't that sound great? Except that in the face of trying to contain runaway prices, this is very difficult. And there was a word you used in their composition, just kind of the composition of businesses. And, you know, one thing that's in the Fed's hopeful outcomes, this idea that they can somehow reduce demand for labor, and do so where the unemployment rate won't really inch up a lot.
You know, the idea that you can reduce demand for labor without eliminating jobs, at least temporarily, is not realistic. You know, if you're going to reduce labor demand, it's going to mean people are going to lose their jobs. Now, the reason why the Fed may hope it can do this is because we have unprecedented vacancies right now. And so let's say that what happens is the increase in interest rates that we've seen starts to affect not just home sales, but new construction. And so a bunch of construction workers start to get laid off in that industry. With high vacancies, what you might hope is that they could find new employment very easily. For instance, state and local governments are having really big problem hiring people right now in this labor market because they haven't been able to increase their wages competitively with the private sector. Well, maybe if people got laid off from construction, they could take jobs in state and local government, make a lot more money doing that than you do by collecting unemployment insurance. And so you might think that there's this very easy transfer where vacancies are eliminated without jobs being lost. That, to me, seems like an overly rosy picture of how the economy works. And the additional problem is that if unemployment doesn't go up, it's not going to take the pressure off of wages that we've seen in this very tight labor market, where the balance of power has really swung from businesses to people because there's such a shortage of workers. And that ultimately is the problem, is that if demand for labor is very strong at an unemployment rate of 3.7%, we're seeing wage gains across the board, not just for people who are changing jobs, but for people who are staying in their existing positions, then ultimately that's the pressure that has to be relieved. And I don't see how you can do that simply by eliminating vacancies without really increasing unemployment and, you know, making the supply of available workers much higher compared to the demand.
Well, and there's a lot we can go into there, and maybe that's topic for another podcast too, but even just an additional point, one of the changes as we think about this kind of the Humpty Dumpty effect and kind of what we know about it now is that there's a shift in willingness to do certain jobs. You know, when you look at obviously state and local government has a lot of vacancies, but even when you drill down into private industry, you see large vacancies in healthcare industry and service related industries. And some of that, you know, we might have a construction worker suddenly looking for a job, but you can't just turn someone into a healthcare worker overnight.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about that, specifically about health. Okay, because healthcare is an area where, you know, the number of jobs in that sector is still about 5% below what it was before, you know, the shutdowns in early 2020. We've also seen substantial wage pressure develop in health. What we haven't seen is that coming through into much higher inflation yet. But it tends to be that healthcare prices are set with a lag based on reimbursement rates for Medicare and Medicaid that go out and are given to hospitals and doctors. And then, you know, the non-Medicare and Medicaid sector, you know, adjusts its prices upwards to sort of stay in balance with what's paid for by government. That tends to be a lag behind, you know, the actual increase in costs. So that's a factor that's lurking in the background to potentially make inflation worse in late 22 and into 2023. Now, healthcare matters because it's the single largest component of the PCE deflator, which is the price index that the Fed really targets its policy to. And so we've sort of gotten a little bit of a free pass here because of the lag between increases in costs and increases in prices for healthcare. And I'm worried that that's going to come through next year and, you know, make inflation stubbornly high. Now, inflation's already been stubbornly high. Yesterday when Jerome Powell, had the press conference after the September FOMC meeting, he mentioned that the Fed had persistently underestimated the persistence of inflation and how sluggish it would be at a high level. And I think, unfortunately, that looks like a condition that could last for longer.
Well, a year ago at this time, you were saying you felt like services inflation and housing inflation could be problems that might be, because there tends to be a lag, that could be a problem going forward. You certainly were not wrong with that one, unfortunately. Maybe let's just shift gears a little bit, because there's an awful lot we can try and pack into a short amount of time, and definitely some imbalances in the labor markets. But you mentioned another imbalance, trade deficit, which also tends to go hand in hand typically when people think about currencies. And another thing we've been watching, of course, Fed hikes, but the dollar has been running away. And this has had important implications for, you know, corporate earnings, emerging market borrowers, other economies.
Well, you know, I was just thinking this morning about this exact issue because the last time we had having a strong currency with a widening trade deficit doesn't go together. If you look at the economics textbooks, you know, countries with large trade deficits are supposed to have weaker currencies in order to bring imports and exports back into balance. And instead, we have kind of a burgeoning trade deficit and a strong dollar, up about 12 or 13% over the past year. The last time, you know, I remember that this was happening was in the early 1980s, where, you know, the U.S. came out of the recessions that were, ended in late 1982, aimed at bringing inflation down. The U.S. economy came roaring back. The trade and current account deficits expanded. you know, the Fed kept tight monetary policy in place well into the recovery, which fueled a stronger dollar. And we got to 1985 and we were in an untenable situation of an extremely strong dollar going hand in hand with a very large trade deficit that required a lot of financing from abroad. And the answer that countries came to was the Plaza Accord, which was an agreement that countries would, you know, orient their policies towards bringing the dollar down. We got a tremendous decline in the dollar over that period, some improvement in the trade deficit, but then a lot of financial instability in the wake of the declining dollar. It provoked, you know, something of a cyclical acceleration in inflation. Number one, its import prices went up, but also, you know, a trade deficit, which was persistent at a weaker dollar, and the U.S. was finding difficulties in financing. Worries about financing it played into the 1987 stock market crash in October. So, you know, financial instability is a worry when things get so far out of whack. And we're really heading to a situation where the current account deficit is uncomfortably wide. The need to attract capital inflows from abroad is correspondingly large, and asset prices are not so attractive as to offer high returns to investors for, you know, investing in the U.S. rather than their home economy. An additional complication is the widening short-term interest rate differential between the U.S. and the rest of the world, because a lot of global fixed income investors hedge themselves at the short end of the yield curve against the currency exposure when they buy U.S. government debt. And because the hedge has become so expensive, recently, the attractiveness of U.S. paper is really declining. So I am concerned about that as, you know, another imbalance that's not resolving, that's brewing as a potential source of instability. And, you know, you never know when these things are going to really come home to roost, but eventually they do.
Well, we don't have a rich history of, let's call it, successful currency interventions over the many decades.
Certainly not of costless ones. Let's put it that way. We have a lot of history of interventions. We don't have a lot of history of dealing with the fallout of those interventions so smoothly.
Well, I certainly want to be mindful of time, Julio, and walk away and leave everyone with really doom and gloom view of the world. I want to highlight just something I've been thinking about recently, and I'm curious if you agree, but you know, there's always some place to go. There's always some place to put money. And it just struck me with, you know, all these Fed hikes, suddenly fixed income is actually a very interesting asset. There's actually income again, yield and income again. So, you know, while we worry about Fed hikes, your policy prescriptions in the past for an inflationary environment have been to shorten up duration, maybe think about certain real assets, but suddenly shorter duration assets have strong returns. Any other takeaways that you may want to leave investors with?
Well, I mean, that's the clearest prescription. If we're, you know, if an endemic inflation problem has set in that the Fed's going to have to really fight against for an extended period of time, then shortening the duration of your assets is kind of the first order implication of that to really preserve wealth and grow it a little. I think the other broader issue is to go up in quality. You know, because the fight against inflation, if it persists, is going to trigger fears about faltering economic growth and potentially a recession, and eventually may require a recession to really solve the inflation problem. So up in quality, I think, is another indication of this, you know, from this kind of environment. And that's something, you know, that applies in various ways to credit and to equities as well. I think you have to think about what quality means in an inflationary environment, because very often people associate quality with low leverage on balance sheets. But of course, leverage is something that's less, you know, dire and less threatening in an inflationary environment than it is in a non-inflationary environment. I think the other thing that investors really need to think about is, you know, kind of taking advantage of managing their portfolios actively, right? Because in an environment where, you know, you start out from high interest rates and you're coasting down into an era of low interest rates, low and stable inflation. Just taking exposure to markets through index funds or through passively managed, you know, assets that really benefit from shrinking risk premia can works very, very well. But if you're in the opposite part of that cycle, where inflation is going up, interest rates are going up, you know, recession risk is going up, then you really have to actively manage your assets to avoid exposure to risk premia that are expanding as much as possible. And so it's not just, you know, what worked in a period of, you know, high and falling rates, high and falling inflation is not going to work on the other side. And so I think some of these things that we've been accustomed to as being, you know, the best way to invest, just minimize cost, buy index funds, you know, don't worry about active management, it's fruitless. Anyway, you know, I think that becomes much less the case when the environment is fraught and you have to really design a more defensive portfolio with respect to that kind of risk.
Certainly anything that's just generically worked for the prior two decades may be time to call into question why exactly it's worked and whether that prescription works.
Well, at a minimum, I think you have to ask yourself, what worked before that's not going to work going forwards, right? And I think that very clearly, if this environment has changed as much as it appears to have at this point in time, you know, you've got to approach successful investing differently.
I think that's a fantastic thought to close on. So, Julio, really want to thank you very much for your time. Just want to remind everyone listening that Julio's commentary on the economy and Fed policy and markets is regularly featured on lordabbott.com. If you'd like a transcript of today's podcast or have any other questions on topics covered today, please contact your Lord Abbott representatives.
Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite streaming app of choice. The U.S. Federal Reserve, or Fed, is the central bank of the United States. The federal funds, or Fed funds, rate is the target interest rate set by the Fed at which commercial banks borrow and lend their excess reserves to each other overnight. Gross domestic product, or GDP, is the monetary value of all finished goods and services produced within a country's borders in a specific time period, though GDP is usually calculated on an annual basis. It includes all private and public consumption, government outlays, investments, and exports, less imports, that occur within a defined territory. Mentions of specific companies are for reference purposes only and are not meant to describe the investment merits of, or potential, or actual portfolio changes related to, securities of those companies. Unless otherwise noted, all discussions are based on U.S. markets and U.S. monetary and fiscal policies. The credit quality of the securities in a portfolio is assigned by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization, or NSRO, such as Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Fitch, as an indication of an issuer's creditworthiness. Ratings range from AAA, which is the highest, to D, which is the lowest. Bonds rated BBB or above are considered investment grade. Credit ratings BB and below are lower rated securities, or junk bonds. High-yielding, non-investment grade bonds, or junk bonds, involve higher risks than investment grade bonds. Adverse conditions may affect the issuer's ability to pay interest and principal on these securities. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. The value of investments in fixed income securities will change as interest rates fluctuate and in response to market movements. Generally, when interest rates rise, the price of debt securities fall, and when interest rates fall, prices generally rise. The municipal market can be affected by adverse tax, legislative, or political changes, and by the financial condition of the issuers of municipal securities. Investments in non-U.S. or emerging market securities, which may be adversely affected by economic, political, or regulatory factors and subject to currency volatility and greater liquidity risk. The value of investments in equity securities will fluctuate in response to general economic conditions and changes in prospects of particular companies and/or sectors in the economy. No investing strategy can overcome all market volatility or guarantee future results. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speaker are those of the speaker as of the date of the broadcast and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market conditions or other conditions, and Lord Abbott disclaims any responsibility to update such views. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice. It is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to adopt any investment strategy. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. The information provided is not directed at any investor or category of investors and is provided solely as general information about Lord Abbott's products and services and to otherwise provide general investment education. None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in or refrain from any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbott nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity. If you are an individual retirement investor, contact your financial advisor or other fiduciary about whether any given instrument, idea, strategy, product, or service may be appropriate for your circumstances. Note to European investors. This communication is issued in the United Kingdom and distributed throughout Europe by Lord Abbott UK Limited, a private limited company registered in England and Wales under company number 10804287 with its registered office at Talis House, 2 Talis Street, Temple, London, United Kingdom, EC4Y0AB. Lord Abbott UK Limited, FRN 783356, is an appointed representative of Kroll Securities Limited, FRN 466588, which is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. This broadcast is copyright 2022 of Lord Abbott & Co. LLC. All rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or in any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Lord Abbott Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbott Distributor, LLC.